Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. As I said last week, this topic that we're discussing, the school-to-prison pipeline, it's huge right now as an issue, and it has been growing more so each week, each month, since, well, maybe somewhere around 2010, and then by 2012, people were beginning to see it and beginning to talk about it more and beginning to see that it has filtered down from the high schools, the middle schools, the elementary schools, the preschools, and that it was becoming a real issue or crisis. We were going to continue the discussion from last week when, beginning of the week, an article was posted about Missouri. Last week, we talked about New York City, the biggest school district in the country, probably in the world, and I described their school-to-prison pipeline history and features of that pipeline, and then this huge amount of money that New York spends every year, close to $750 million. I think the exact figure was $747 million, and the old saying that the way New York goes, so goes the nation, maybe. So that's where we were. And then I was going to continue more with the history and examples around the country. And then this article pops up on Missouri. On our promotion, those of you who get our promotion on Facebook, we gave you a link for that topic, for that issue, I'm sorry, for that post. And I hope you went and you read it, and then the comments, over 200 and some odd comments in almost a day or so, and I think that's a lot. And so if you did, today's conversation will even be more meaningful, I think. When I read the article, I don't consider myself an expert yet. I'm working on becoming an expert on the school-to-prison pipeline. I think I know more about it than most parents, public school teachers, even university professors in education, university professors, criminal justice system, university professors who may be involved in juvenile justice. I taught a course, a college course, juniors and seniors and graduate student, juvenile law and procedures. I taught criminology. I taught deviance. I taught social movements. I taught about gangs, you name it. But I don't consider myself an expert, specifically with an expert title on that specific narrow subject. But I'm becoming one because I'm working on it. And I'm saying what I just said because when I read that article, it bothered the hell out of me. I read it somewhere around about 9 o'clock that night when it was posted. I could not get it out of my head. I went to bed, I couldn't sleep. I would sleep an hour, half an hour, and I wake up and I'm thinking about it. And that would go on throughout the night. And I'm going to tell you why it bothered me in a minute or two. But for those who don't get our promotion, and or those who didn't go and read the article themselves, let me give you sort of like the gist of it. And it went something like this, that the state of Missouri, the legislature, had created a new law or modified an existing law that took effect January 1st, 2017. This new law, basically, it's not funny, I'm saying, because it's so ridiculous. This new law, in essence, says that if kids are fighting in school, and I'm hesitating because I want you to hear what I'm saying, kids. Now, they're not talking about high school. They're not talking about junior high. They're talking about all kids, kindergarten through 12. And I don't know, maybe even preschool, but all kids, all grades, all ages. If you're fighting in school, the school now is required by law to inform the local police about the fight, provide details, in essence, turning it over, the incident over to law enforcement. Previously, if you were fighting in school, the school would handle it in the school. Like in most areas of the country. And the schools could determine what should be done. Sometimes the schools would send it off campus to the police department or to juvenile detention court or juvenile court or what have you. And the worst thing that would happen to you would be you would be charged with a misdemeanor and parole to your parents, and you're back in school. Or if your school has, say, suspended you maybe for a week or two, whatever, then you go back to school. That was how it was handled. Those were the people who did the handling of the situation. In Missouri now, if third graders, second graders, fourth graders, eighth graders, 12th graders get into a fight, regardless to who started it, it would be a situation where the school is under mandatory regulation to report it to the local law enforcement agency. Once that happens, either the designated person in law enforcement or the chief or whomever, quote, supposed to review the incident, make a decision whether or not to send it to the local prosecutor. Local prosecutor gets it, he or she reviews the facts and makes a decision whether or not this is going to be a felony issue. And if they decide it's a felony issue, then they refer it to the court, and then you can be, and at some point you may even be already placed and juvenile detention while all this is going on. And once these steps take place, of course, this is the beginning of the school or prison pipeline. In theory, once the police, if the police is on campus already, like we have now in many places, or they're called, once the police come and make a decision and they put handcuffs on you, you are formally under their jurisdiction. You're formally being detained. Your right of movement, your right of anything and everything, somewhat, when I say somewhat, suspended, and their rights are now superseding many of your civil rights, constitutional rights. Take you to jail, and when they book you on suspicion or what have you, you start the process is what I'm talking about. And you know, you've seen it on television, the mugshot, the fingerprinting, and what have you. And the charges may be specified or charges pending, and then you're in the system at that point. We're talking about elementary school kids here. The law applies to all ages. I can't even get it out. All ages, all grades in the state. We're talking mandatory action that must be taken. I did not read what penalties, if the school doesn't inform local law enforcement, would be imposed for not complying with the law. I don't know what would happen to a teacher if a fight breaks out in his or her room and they are aware of this law, and hence they break up the fight, they don't tell the administration, and hence the administration can't call the police or send information to the police as required. I don't know what happens if a teacher breaks up a fight, tells the principal, and the principal doesn't send it. That the law was not laid out in specifics. So, one of the first things here that scares the hell out of me is this. If you follow what I just said to you that the teacher, principal, the school board, the elected school board in most cases here, no longer have anything to say and do with the discipline of students. Nowhere in this chain of discussion that I laid out, from once the school called the local police, they're out of it. Local police, prosecutor, juvenile detention or juvenile court, juvenile agency, whatever they call it in that state, and then court. Nowhere did you hear me say anything that the school has a representative there and they're talking about it and they're providing any kind of input or recommendations. Parents, you're out of it. If this isn't frightening to you, it certainly hell is to me. We are, with this law, and here's the thing, the other thing that really had me upset and couldn't sleep was that other states, I bet you anything, are going to duplicate this. They may duplicate it word for word, especially, for example, if it was an Alex. You remember who Alex is? The legislative exchange, conservative, alt-right conservative group who get together and create laws and hand those laws to people who belong to Alex, and those mostly legislatures, state senators, assembly, even congressmen, what have you. They go back and they seek to get the laws that Alex has created to become law in their state. And we see those laws that Alex creates, they are copied word for word. And sometimes they don't even change the letterhead, I'm told, and what I've seen through my research. And so that if this law is duplicated, and in some cases made even more stringent, that to me is a nightmare. And if you did see this article, and as I said earlier, if you read some of the comments only reinforce the nightmare scenario that I guess I projected from when I was looking at this law for the first time. And specifically, it says here, police, law enforcement, juvenile office, prosecutors to determine whether a student shall be charged with a crime or if action needs to be brought in juvenile court regarding the actions of the particular student. Now, you call it a bias if you want, but you know what's going to happen when the police making a decision? It's going to be a crime. You know what's going to happen when the prosecutor is making a decision? It's going to be a crime. You know what's going to happen when juvenile court gets involved? I bet you anything, it's going to be a crime. And I'll go further. You know who is going to be reported for the fighting? In 90-some-odd percent, I'm using that term, 90-some-odd percent of the cases that are reported, it's going to be your students of color, it's going to be your disabled students, it's going to be your poor. That pattern is already well-established. I think I've even commented before that the black and brown poor kid, they get sent from the schools to law enforcement, where the white kid, white middle class kid in particular and up, they get sent to therapy. They get sent to therapy. Just like white adults, criminal crimes. Like all the people on Wall Street who should have been prosecuted, not one. Back here when the war on drugs started, Congress of the United States, federal government, created a distinction in this war on drugs. Powder cocaine is what the middle class, the upper class, the entertainers, people with money, and they were snorting powder cocaine. The poor folks, they couldn't afford powder. They got rock cocaine. Congress then sets up two different classes of crime. Powder cocaine, you got a slap on the wrist compared to the rock cocaine. You got users or sellers, manufacturers with rock cocaine, they threw literally the book at you. For they set up the amount that you could, if you got pulled over, you were stopped or what have you, and you had cocaine on you, depending on how much you had, I think it was 5 ounces. Don't quote me on this. And if it was 6, you got the book thrown at you. And I'm saying this because when I told you, was it almost 2 weeks ago, that I visited a federal penitentiary, I think it was a minimum security penitentiary, and it was inmates who were, I guess they got close to being put out of the prison in terms of going to a halfway house or going on probation, or maybe they're finishing their terms of the sentence. They put on this program, an annual program that's in the entire Justice Department, what have you, from all across the country are invited to come in or send representatives, and they put on this program. At the table that I was sitting, we had two inmates. One that was the closest to me, and he and I were talking. He has, I think, and again, these numbers, since I don't know about drugs and what have you, I think I got it right. He had 6 ounces of cocaine when they arrested him. For that, he got 30 years. I think he was in his late teens or early 20s. Because when I met him, he had spent 17 years. And he was a young guy. And we talked about the disparity in the sentencing, and now Congress was considering, yes, we were rather racist when we created those penalties, and now they're thinking about some type of amnesty law that says, okay, instead of being 30, 40, 50, 60 years, it should have been no more than, say, 10, 15, what have you. If you're in prison now and you have been all this time, we're going to give you a form of amnesty. You'll be able to get out if once we pass this law. Lots of luck with that. But anyway, we have this racial disparity. We've always had this racial disparity in the criminal justice system. That's why many of us call it the criminal injustice system. We had juvenile courts, and juvenile laws were created so that they would not be treated like adults. That was the purpose of creating juvenile law and procedures. Remember I told you I taught the course. And since about the early 1990s, possibly a little bit before, and of course in the South, what I'm about to say was taking place forever, but in the early 1990s and forward, this notion of we started treating juveniles more and more like adults. In some states, mostly the southern states, we started saying that if you were 14 years old, you would be treated like an adult. And you could be sentenced to life imprisonment as a 14-year-old. You could be sentenced to execution as a 14-year-old. And I just remembered something now. When I was teaching criminal justice, this was the late 1980s, and I haven't thought about this since then. In this particular class that I was teaching, I said, there will come a time when this country will start executing kids. Lethal injection, electrocution, they will start executing kids. My students were arguing me left and right. No way, no way. And I said, let me tell you when it's going to happen. I said, it's going to be a situation where a white woman, a white girl, is going to accuse a young black male who could be 10 or 11, 12 of rape. And if that person dies or was killed and people said it was Joe Black over here who did it and he was 11 or 12, he's going to be arrested, he's going to be convicted, and some prosecutor is going to recommend that that person be put to death. Well, this is what, I said, say 90, so we're talking almost 30 years ago. And everyone thought I was crazy. Well, folks, we have had young black men sentenced to life imprisonment when they're in their early teens, and I think there was a case when maybe the person wasn't even a teenager yet. And this became a pattern. Again, we're teachers. Most of us don't follow the stuff that I'm talking about. But it wasn't that long ago, just a couple years ago, that the U.S. Supreme Court said, oh, wait a minute. You can't put a kid 10, 11, 12, 13 years old in prison for life without the possibility of parole. You can put a person who is, I'll just say, 13, who may live to be 70, 3 or 4 or 5 times the age of which he was at the time, quote, he committed the crime. He may die. And so even if conservative Supreme Court said, hold on, wait a minute, this is wrong, and da-da-da-da. The putting youth to official execution has also been challenged. I say all this to say that with this law in Missouri, I know that it's going to be abused. And if I was the richest man in America, I would bet everything I had that the sheriff, the prosecutor, everyone involved are going to abuse this law. And I've got 400 years of history to back up my bet. That's what was keeping me awake. It frightens the hell out of me because this is just another damn nail in the coffin. And it's happening in our schools. Further, to me, I saw it as, and I sort of like just hinted at this, our schools are going to come, it's going to get to a point where we're not going to have schools anymore. I want to count 1, 2, 3, 4. We're going to have prisons. Our schools are going to become prisons. Now, probably pissing off a whole lot of people, which is usual when I say this. No more schools as we have known them. No more school to prison pipeline, because the schools will become prisons. Now, we think about when we talked about last year and before that, when the KIPP schools, charter schools, and they're following zero tolerance, no excuses, then the charter schools and now some of the public schools. And I told you, I think it was last week, back in the 90s and part of the 80s, I saw the zero tolerance being put in schools in Los Angeles. And this was a public school. There was virtually, I won't say no charter schools back in the 80s, but public schools was going with the zero tolerance thing. And so when we look at what was taking place in the 80s and 90s, the 2000, now we're in the teens, 2010, 2015, and we look at maybe glacier speed, but schools across the country, now they look like fortress. Well, I'll use New York as an example. I mean, the vast number of children who have to go through metal detectors to get in schools. Now they've got devices where the little robots go up and down the hallways and what have you, and they can detect, I guess, metal. But Glocks are made out of plastic. That's a gun, a Glock manufacturer. But everybody, and then you got all the cops / resource officers. And they have, you know this, teachers, this you should already know. You know when kids come into school, most of their civil rights, the ones that, quote, we were supposed to have as American citizens, go out the window. You know that already. You don't have, kids don't have the freedom, First Amendment. Kids don't have the protection against unlawful search and seizure. Kids don't have other rights in school or in a jurisdiction in which the school proclaims as their jurisdiction. Some areas, you know, I think you know what I'm talking about, that maybe so many feet, so many blocks away from the schoolhouse itself is the school's jurisdiction. So even though you may not be in the school or on the steps or 10, 15 feet out in the yard or what have you, if the jurisdiction extends a block or two or three or whatever, you're still within the school jurisdiction and your civil rights and civil liberties are still suspended until you're out of the jurisdiction. You go into some of these schools, it's a fortress. They have more cops than social workers, counselors, and not just New York City that I talked about last week when they have put 5,500 versus 2,500 social workers and counselors combined, and they spend, what is it, 300 some odd million just on taking care of the resource officers and maintaining this fortress-like school structure. It's a creeping process, but it's happening, that schools are becoming more like prisons than schools. And every time, and this is something else that I wanted to talk about last week, and I didn't get to it. Every time there is a shooting, and especially mass shooting in the schools, there's a ratcheting up, and you know this to be true, a ratcheting up of the call for more security. That's always the case. You create a crisis, and then you say the solution to it is increase the budget for defense, increase the budget for policing, increase the budget for prisons, what have you. It becomes the excuse that people feel that they need in order to do what they want to do. Some go even as far as creating a manufacturing the crisis in order to say, we have the crisis, and this is how we should deal with it. I attended, back in March, another one-day conference. It was over 1,000, some odd, police officers, law enforcement, the whole gamut, federal, state, city, you name it. And the company that was presenting the large part of the program, they were talking about crisis of ISIS, you know, the Middle East, where the war between ISIS and the United States and some of the governments there, the Muslim, and the threat that ISIS has in terms of reaching out to disaffected, mostly white, young students to embrace the Islamic cause and to become either terrorists, using the word terrorists here, or getting out of the country, coming to the Middle East, being trained and come back and what have you. And almost the entire morning was spent about ISIS. And then just before the break, they said, well, we're going to talk, maybe if we have time, about homegrown terrorists here, like the white nationalists, white supremacists, and the black terrorists, and what have you. They spent maybe, if they got to it, just a minute or two, and said they were doing the ISIS thing. Now, what I'm alluding to here is that the Columbine and all the other student-involved mass killings did not take place in urban schools. The shooters, the students, were not black, were not brown. They were white. But yet and still, when those incidents happen, there's this human cry in Washington and other city capitals of the need to better protect our schools. Safe School Act. And the millions and tens of millions and billions of dollars then being pumped in so that they can put more police, and the police carry automatic weapons, and police have access to armored vehicles, they have access to some really high-powered weaponry. And where are they going? They're going to the schools. And so there have been books, especially since 2010, that start talking about the school-to-prison pipeline, and they are beginning to move to, if my position is radical, they're beginning to move more to my position that schools are going to become prisons. You won't have any more schools. They'll all be prisons. So, when again, this Missouri law had me upset because I'm thinking many of the things that I've, spent our first half an hour talking about. And so that there's something that maybe would have been more appropriate last week, but it's definitely appropriate right now also. You know me, I like going back to history. My old Edmund Burke quote, those who don't know, history is doomed to repeat it. But this attack on students, it really had, and I mentioned this part before, that the Supreme Court decision in 1954, integrating the schools, how the police started showing up at those schools where black students were, quote, integrating the schools, and maybe 10, 20, 30 black students, and several hundred white students, but the police were there to make sure that the black students didn't harm the white students. And I tell you about the incident that happened at my middle school when I was in the seventh grade. I'm just turning 12 years old. I told you about that. And so it goes back to then, and of course, in the South, it goes back even further. But there's something that happened. The late 80s, the early 1990s, I'll basically call this guy a colleague, a professor, who was looking at what he called juvenile violence, a very prestigious school. He was a professor. And he saw this trend, he thought, at looking at the data, that juvenile crimes were becoming more frequent and more violent, and that this was happening steadily, going up year after year after year. Doing his research, he goes to a prison. He talks to an inmate, a black inmate, an adult. And that prisoner was saying, yeah, things are getting rough out there. Yes, it's getting really violent and what have you. And the prisoner says, it's like they're becoming predators. Our researcher takes this. That's the term that I can use to describe what I'm seeing. And so he adds the word, super to it, become super predators. This was 1995. So we're talking 22 years or so ago. And when I was thinking about this and making a note to bring this up, I kept saying to myself, teachers who have been teaching for a long time, maybe some who are maybe new to teaching but grew up in the last 15 years or so, my question is, do you remember hearing this term, super predator? Of course, you can't answer me right now, but it was the thing. It became the explanation for the violence that was taking place in urban centers, the violence that had been perpetuated by urban youth. And when they use urban, it's always we're talking black, brown folks and poor. The guy then had, he's a theorist like myself and what have you, he then had a concept that he just expanded into a theory, and he had the data to back up his theory and whatever elements of his theory that he wanted to advance as being truth. Super predator. That caught on like wildfire. The news media, the national news media, the hot shot liberal media people all had shows and guests talking about this notion of super predator. Very quickly, super predator was youth violence that was being perpetrated by youth who had almost no impulse control, no conscience, immoral savages who would kill other people, be it youth, adults, it didn't matter, because he was creating a special class. He was saying that they're now, and he didn't go as far as talking about genetics, that there's been this genetic switch that has taken place, and that in this youth population, you're going to find X number of these predators that are predators based upon genetic changes. But he was saying that youth are becoming more violent. They are the type of people who kill innocent people, who will kill you and don't even think about it, have no remorse whatsoever, and they are going to grow exponentially year after year. It's going to get to a point where whole society is going to be in danger from this. I'm having a hard time here because I remember the period, and of course, I thought he was full of shit. And the other people who were buying onto it, this was like eugenics that we talked about. This was science, and so hence, he was telling the truth. Yeah, he could back it up with his data or what have you. But it became the explanation for looking at all black youth as predators, and that we should be afraid of black youth individually and collectively. When you see them coming down the street, you fear for your life, because these were people who would engage in violence. They had no impulse control. They had no moral code. They just were basically, they had no consciousness. They were just uncaged animals who would kill on a whim. I want to get that. I know I'm saying some of the things over and over again, but I want to get that in, because that concept then would be used by legislatures, federal, state, city, county, to justify creating laws, justify arming police officers, justified and further expanding police use of force as being justified, and on and on and on. And we, to this day, are operating under that super predator notion. Well, within about 10 years, other scientists begin to say what I had said in the very beginning. This is bullshit. The data of this super predator growing in number, the crimes being more violent and getting worse year after year after year, wasn't happening. In fact, there was a decline year after year after year. So much so that the original author of this came out and said, I was wrong. And the unintended consequences of me being wrong have been horrendous. The number of black youth that was sent to jail and back to New York, I don't know if you guys remember this, when 4 or 5 black men were accused of, I know it was rape and maybe murder, in Central Park, and they were sent to jail for decades, only to be, and they were sent to jail because of, they were called super predators. Convicted in the story. Turns out later, they were innocent, all of them. They finally got released. New York City paid tens of millions of dollars. I mean, if you can, like, give people money to compensate for being in prison for 10, 15, 20, 30 years and the prospect of dying in prison. And so, even today, you know, law enforcement are saying, what was the guy in Missouri, Ferguson, when he shot the young guy? And he said, this guy was huge, he was menacing, he was frightened, and he thought this guy could rip him apart, more or less, these are my words now. And so he shoots him. He was unarmed, but he shoots him. And how many other cases recently, this year, last year, year before that, where the black teenagers, black kids, 10, 11, 12 years old, are shot, killed, and the shooting officer pleads, I fear for my life. The super predator phenomena is still there. Even though it's been discredited, it was a myth, it still is very pervasive in our society. And so I'm thinking that with this law in Missouri, we're creating another super predator myth that's going to be the consequences, the intended and the unintended consequences, if it's the law is adopted, modified more stringently across the country. It's going to do nothing but turn our schools into prisons, speed up the incubation process of sending our kids to bigger prisons from the smaller schools that are prisons. And guess what? teachers, and I said this when we did our first two shows on School of Prison Pipeline back in 2014, I think it was. I said, teachers' roles have changed. Teachers are the gatekeepers for the School of Prison Pipeline. This is before this law. Because the teachers make the decision, do I call the resource officer? Do I call the office? Do I call whomever and say, this kid did X, Y, Z, and then the kid is put into a process? Or do I deal with it in my classroom? Like in the old days when teachers, you remember those days when you were in prep, becoming a teacher, they taught you class management was very important. In some cases, it may be even more important than the subject matter. Those days are gone. They've been gone for a long time. And to sort of like finish up where I started here, last Tuesday, I was in Rochester, New York, and a teacher, after I gave my, a lot of people gave talks away, but I gave my talk. I think I mentioned something like this last week in terms of, I'm now working in this area, and I'm building a model. And my model goes something like this. School to prison pipeline, prison to school pipeline. Decrease one, increase one equals a win-win for everyone. And, you know, they understand that and everybody thinks it's fantastic. But what I'm saying is that we need to decrease the school to prison pipeline. And then we need to look at that prison. And I'm talking about our kids now. I'm not talking about adult offenders. I'm talking about our kids who go to juvie and who are being put into the criminal justice systems from the classrooms. I'm not talking about the kids who are out there shooting up each other and shooting up people. Yes, they're juveniles, some of them, and they're going, I'm talking about the kids who get into the criminal justice system from our classroom, from our schools. I'm saying that we need to decrease that, and decrease is a code word for me. We need to destroy, obliterate that whole concept and practice. And then on the other end, we shouldn't give up on all of our kids who end up committing some violation in schools. It depends upon the severity, and that we should work to put these kids back in school. And when I was at the prison and I was talking to the people there, when I was at the school, middle school last week talking, I made it a particular point to say, when I say back in school, I'm not talking about getting a GED. I'm talking about getting our kids either back into the public school or some alternative school with the intent not just to get a GED or not just to get a diploma. I want to see us do what we can to get those kids into college. Stay with those kids, get them into graduating with their BA, either going to graduate school, becoming doctors, becoming law students, becoming teachers, engineers, what have you. And when I said this to the, when I was at the federal prison and I was talking to the national leaders coming from the justice system and what have you, and you name it, I looked at them specifically and I said this, I want these kids to come out of the prisons, come out of the detention centers, get back into schools. I want us to provide the services that they need, the counseling, the tutoring, and the financial support. I want the colleges to be able to continue this wraparound service that we're now talking about for the community schools. And then I looked at the officials there and I said, and I want you, the city folks, the county folks, the state folks, the federal folks, I want you to give these kids shot at state, federal jobs, middle-class jobs that would allow them to buy a home, middle-class jobs that will give them health benefits, give them retirement pay. I want you to do what no other programs are doing. I want you to have them back in schools where they can rekindle relationship with the teachers. You know, and I've said this, and I hope you guys believe it, that the relationship that we have with our students from kindergarten all the way through could be the best relationship many of our students will ever have, and we as adults would have as well. I don't see this relationship. Everything is tearing away the relationship between student and teachers. Then I want the students to see from the beginning of coming into our program that at the end of this program, there is hope. Not bullshit, but real hope that we're going to stay with them all through school, get them out of college, and then that there will be jobs. And that's where I believe the state, the city, the county, the feds, you have an obligation. You may not see it as your obligation, but I believe you have an obligation. You're taking tax money. You're making all these damn laws. You have an obligation to say to these kids that if we get them back into school and through school, that you will hire them, give them an opportunity that maybe some of the corporates won't do. And that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm upset about. That's where the laws that comes out of Missouri pisses me off, because I see it setting my kids up to become prisoners in elementary, preschools, middle schools, and high schools, and that this is ominous, and it's against everything that I think schools has always been about, and public schools, when it became a public responsibility back in Massachusetts 150-some-odd years ago. This school-to-prison pipeline is atrocious, and we as teachers should not have a single role in this. My time is up. As usual, I had more to talk about than I had time to do it. Next week, we start our month-long celebration of our teachers. Have a good one, everyone. See you next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.